So good morning, everyone. This is my first time leading a Nishmat Hayim teaching, and I must begin with my gratitude to Moshe, Bobby, Reggie, Sheila, for the collective wisdom and inspiration that I have received from you over the 6 years of my participation, and for all that you gave to my late husband, David Breakstone, in the years before that. David always came back from the Friday morning Sangha at TBZ re-enlivened. And when he could no longer drive, Sheila, bless you, Sheila, drove him every Friday morning from Belmont to Brookline, and then back to Watertown. And then when he was in hospice at Belmont Manor, you all visited him. And Sheila, you would bring your guitar and sing to David. After David died at home on April 1st, 2020, at the very start of the pandemic, only 10 people were allowed at his burial at Mount Auburn Cemetery. And singing was considered a dangerous activity. So there was no singing. And that loss of community singing felt to me like one of the crueler losses of the pandemic. Just when we needed it the most. At the unveiling a year later, 25 of us were allowed, and Reb Moshe could bring his resonant chanting of the prayers and his invoking of Yah. Yah, I think that may come from Arthur Wasco, who just died last October. So that's the out-breath, Yah, that is the holy name. And then the following year at a memorial gathering, Bobby and Reggie and Sheila came to the cemetery and chanted the same Nagun that I opened with, I am alive. I want to say there is nothing like chanting, I am alive, at the grave of a loved one to inspire awe at the miracle of one's own aliveness. I also want to lead with gratitude to Rabbi Everett Gendler of blessed memory, who has been my most important spiritual teacher in a lifetime when I have been blessed with many extraordinary teachers. Everett also died on April 1st, 4 years ago. David and I met him in 1966 when he was a speaker on Jewish-Christian dialogue, and David and I were desperately seeking encouragement for our own interfaith marriage, which Everett generously supplied. He is honored both for his leadership for civil rights. He marched with Martin Luther King at Selma. He organized rabbis to hear and support King. And he's also known as the father of the modern environmental movement in Judaism. David and I followed Everett and his wife, Mary Gendler, into organic gardening and vegetarianism as a form of eco-kashrut. And I used to tease Everett that he set me on his pagan path with his attention to the cycles of the moon, his blessing of their compost piles, and the maple that we danced around at Lag BaOmer just celebrating everything that made the new harvest possible, the new planting and growing and harvest possible. One of the contributions for which he is remembered is installing the first solar-powered eternal light, the Ner Tamid, at the Reform Temple Emmanuel, our temple, in Lowell, Massachusetts, in 1978. That was almost 50 years ago. Now there are congregations across the United States who put their ethic of care for the earth into action by covering the roofs of their synagogues with solar panels that power not only their eternal lights, but their whole building with non-polluting energy. And I have to pause and invite you to marvel with me at the coincidence that right now there are workers going back and forth outside my windows, installing the solar-powered heat pumps that were supposed to be installed last November or December. And I thought, isn't this so right that it's happening today? And I told them they had to stop their hammering for an hour and a half. But I love the coincidence, the more than coincidence. Another teacher I wanted to connect with more deeply as I prepared for this Devar Torah was the Vietnamese Buddhist monk Thich Nhat Hanh. I had always been attracted to his concept of inner being, but I had never before read his book of that title. So I got the book and learned that the order of inner being was formed in February 1966. 60 years ago, this month, at a time when the Vietnam War was escalating and the teachings of the Buddha were desperately needed to combat the hatred, violence, and divisiveness enveloping his country, I was amazed at his foresight. In the intervening decades, many revolutionary movements have challenged our rigid categories of separation, anti-racism, feminism, the LGBTQ movement, environmentalism, quantum physics, the reemergence of indigenous wisdom have all upended our paradigms of a world of solid, separate things arranged in hierarchies of value and power. And before all of them, earlier than all of them, was this humble Buddhist community finding in their mindfulness trainings the keys to the sacredness and interconnection of all beings. There are 14 mindfulness trainings for engaged Buddhism. So I'm focusing today on the 11th mindfulness training for the order of interbeing. I'm going to read it to you. Quote, "Aware that great violence and injustice have been done to our environment and society, we are committed not to live with a vocation that is harmful to humans and nature. We will do our best to select a livelihood that helps realize our ideal of understanding and compassion. Aware of global economic, political, and social realities, we will behave responsibly as consumers and as citizens, not investing in companies that deprive others of their chance to live." Of course, this resonates with Everett's environmentalism, and it turns out also to have a direct connection with the Torah portion for the week, Exodus 27 through 30. You can imagine my astonishment when I found it beginning with these words. God told Moses, "You will command the Israelites to bring you clear olive oil crush for the luminary to kindle the lamp regularly. Aaron and his sons will set up the lighting apparatus in the tent of meeting outside the curtain concealing the Ark of Testimony before God, ensuring that the lamps burn from later afternoon until morning. This will be an eternal duty of the Israelites throughout their generations." Like, really? I said, what were the chances that this would be the Torah portion assigned to me, supposedly at random? The coincidence just knocked me over. Again, the so-called coincidence. I heard once that coincidence is God's way of remaining anonymous. So that's what it felt like. And as I sat with it, it just laid to rest my insecurities about not knowing Hebrew, not being a qualified teacher of Judaism or Buddhism, not having anything legitimate to offer. It just all settled in me, because here was the divine choreography inviting me to join the ongoing dance and to add my small light to the eternal flame. So thank you all so much for trusting me, inviting me. I love how the Exodus instructions and Everett's solar invention embody two different ethics of care. The first is a rhythm of small commitments performed at the same time every day, in this case, late afternoon and morning. Like most forms of care, it cannot be done once and for all. Babies have to be nursed and burped, their diapers changed multiple times a day. Cows have to be fed and milked at certain times. Herds of goats and sheep moved from pasture to pasture in given rhythms. The crops sown and watered and harvested according to the seasons. And that olive oil, it came from trees who had to be tended when they were saplings. And then there was the work of the community to harvest their fruit as they matured. So here are these ongoing daily rituals of care with special brachot, blessings, the Jewish prayers that elevate these ordinary actions of the day. How different is the solar nartamid? On the other hand, it's installed with prayers of thanks and dedication, but then it does its work without further human intervention. So, you know, what is the equivalent of the ethic of care in that case? And I thought the 11th mindfulness training was really the key. It's a key to right action, because unlike the olive oil of our ancestors, the coal and oil and gas that kept lights burning in the 20th century pollute the air and land and waters. They, quote, deprive others of their right to live. Both the animals and human communities directly harmed, and all of the interconnected planetary systems that are disrupted by climate change. By concentrating power in a few corporations, an energy system built on petrochemicals contributes to economic injustice and to wars fought for scarce oil reserves. So the Buddha's commitment to, quote, behave responsibly as consumers and as citizens clearly makes the solar eternal light the necessary choice in the commitment not to harm humans and nature. And I keep thinking of that with all the disruption that's going on in my house right now. And kind of those mini splits, they're pretty ugly. But I said, yes, this is what we are commanded to do. And although the physical solar light requires no daily tending, it does invite reverence for the sun itself, the source of all energy on our earth, shining equally on all. It's a perfect icon of interbeing. And the Jewish prayers for greeting the sun as it rises and sets each day aren't those a form of spiritual care that encompasses the solar light. From Psalm 19, the heavens recite God's glory, and the sky declares the handiwork of the Creator. Or another variation, Holy One of Blessing, your presence fills creation, inviting our awe at the splendor of the universe. This Holy One of Blessing, your presence fills creation, is the language that we used at Temple Emmanuel and the language that my grandchildren are learning for home blessings. And I think it is a beautiful expression of interbeing. So there's all that about the eternal light. And then there's another part of the Torah reading of the Tetzaveh that just fascinated me. So I'm going to ask your patience to speak a little about that. The following chapter, I just was fascinated by this. I didn't get it at first. The following chapter gives detailed instructions for creating the sacred vestments for Aaron and his sons to fit them for their role as priests. As each garment is listed, breastplate, ephod, robe, tunic, turban, and sash, the same instruction is repeated. Quote, the artisans must make the ephod out of threads composed of gold, turquoise wool, purple wool, scarlet wool, and twined linen with a woven design. Quote, this list is repeated 5 times. The colors purple and scarlet had very specific symbolic meanings as markers of royalty in the Roman Empire. Tyrian purple dye from Phoenicia required thousands of sea snails to produce, and only emperors were allowed to wear the royal purple. Second, in indicating wealth and power, was the color scarlet, produced at great expense from tiny insects found in the Mediterranean. Roman officers wore scarlet cloaks to mark their authority. I don't know how the turquoise dye was made, maybe from copper or lapis lazuli, but it also must have been like gold and purple and scarlet, a rare and costly indication that these priestly vestments elevated their wearers to be able to enter the court of divine majesty. We are not told who made the garments. We know that not just anyone could make them because, quote, God told Moses, you must speak to everyone who is wise of heart, in whom I have invested a spirit of wisdom, and they must make Aaron's vestments to consecrate him to minister to me. I do know that in ancient cultures, it was always the women who cleaned and carded and dyed and spun and wove wool into linen and garments. All over the world, the spindle and loom have been symbols of women's work. Women had their own rituals, blessings, and songs for this sacred work, a subculture apart from male rituals and symbols. Certainly that was not named in our Torah reading. The Parsha as a whole is relentlessly male. Aaron's sons as the priests, the 12 tribes of Israel, each headed by a man. Even the animals to be sacrificed must be male. And of course, the Holy One is here envisioned as a male warrior king. But when God named the garment makers as, quote, wise of heart, worthy to make Aaron's vestments, might that have been a hidden recognition of the daughters of Aaron? I take some comfort from imagining the hidden presence of the women with their sacred work of carding, spinning, dyeing, and weaving the wool for the priestly garments. That seems to me the wholeness that constitutes interbeing. So thank you for your kind listening. Now I welcome your thoughts in response to my thoughts or anything that arose for you in our shared set.